I'm Bill Radke. Welcome to KUOW's The Record. Seattle has become divided over the issue of homelessness. That's according to Mayor Ed Murray. Tonight, he will give a speech updating the city on the state of emergency he declared over the homelessness crisis. But Murray also wants to address that polarization he's seeing in the city.
We hear two conversations. One is that the homeless are criminal drug addicts, and the other is that the city is just trying to sweep the homeless out of the right-of-way of the freeway or off of our sidewalks to hide the problem. And neither one of those conversations are correct. Some homeless, particularly a few who are drug addicts, are actually committing crimes. And contrary to the conversation in some neighborhoods, the police are actually arresting them and enforcing the law. And we are not sweeping people out of illegal encampments to hide them. We're going in. We're offering services. We're cleaning up garbage, human feces, and needles. We're trying to take care of people, trying to get them out of there. It's not going to be easy, and it's not going to happen quickly.
Well, some residents, including people who live in Ballard, Magnolia, are hiring private security forces because they say that you're wrong. The police aren't enforcing the law. Why wouldn't they know what they're talking about?
Here's the reality. Under a new chief, Chief O'Toole, a new command staff, this department is policing. And the most recent statistics the chief gave me as recently as a week ago, crime overall in the city is down 10%. So I think we need to be reality based here. Just because a lot of people are on a lot of social media sites that didn't exist before talking about crimes that may have happened, I'm going to trust Chief O'Toole. Does that mean we don't have problems? We've got problems, but we're getting on top of those problems.
So are you saying these residents are having their fears whipped up in a sort of an echo chamber?
I think in part, yes. In part, people are having their cars broken into. In part, property crime is a problem. And yes, there are some homeless, particularly some who are deep into a drug addiction, who are committing crimes. But we've got people living in houses that are committing crimes. We got people who work in jobs who are committing crimes. So yes, I think some people have decided to denigrate and vilify the homeless and try and equate homelessness with crime. And it's just not the case.
Let's talk about the unauthorized tent camps. Seattle has cleared out about 40 unsanctioned homeless tent encampments since November. The city calls it a cleanup. I've heard advocates call these sweeps. Either way, city council members and some advocates have raised concerns. Why are these cleanups or sweeps necessary?
So we have people living in places that aren't safe. We've had folks fall off the freeway where they've been sleeping and die. We've had people murdered in these tents. People are being raped in these tents. So instead of doing sweeps, which was the old model, we're slowly scaling up intervention teams and hiring people to clean up garbage and feces and needles. We're going in and we're attempting to get people services. I don't know what is so humane about saying, let's not touch those people. Let's just leave them in their addiction. So I realize, again, it's fun to have this like outdated conversation, bad mayor sweeping the homeless out, trying to hide them, when in fact is what we're doing is trying to offer them services, trying to clean up the city so we don't have a public health crisis. Now, if the council wants us to step down and not do this type of intervention, then I would encourage them to pass a resolution and we can see how the city feels about that.
What about the issue of the one-night count coming up? This is how we assess the homelessness problem. It's how we allocate money to solve it or to ameliorate it. How does clearing out some of these encampments and scattering people, how does that help us get an accurate one-night count?
You know, I think that's incredibly offensive. We are not clearing out people. We're getting people into treatment. We're getting people into housing. How is that a bad thing? The reason for the state of emergency, an unusual thing to do in a human service crisis, was because I recognize the problem is growing greater in that we need greater funds. So that seems to me to be like old political games versus actually trying to build a partnership in Seattle. To accuse us the people who've actually invested more money than any point in the history of the city, the mayor who actually signed a declaration of emergency, went to D.C. to ask for more federal funding, to say that we're trying to hide homelessness is just offensive and, I suspect, cheap politics.
You've added more shelter beds. You've opened city-run tent camps, vehicle parking lots. What else do you plan to do with your state of emergency powers?
A state of emergency, as in an earthquake, is a request for aid from the state and federal government. That's what the city of Bellingham just asked. That's why Portland did a state of emergency. That's why the governor of the state of Hawaii did a state of emergency. We have done, as a city, all we can do. What we're asking for is we all need extra help. We all need assistance with mental health and drug treatment. There isn't a county in this country that has enough affordable housing. It isn't going to be Seattle solving this problem. We're asking people to stop this conversation about Seattle can solve it or Seattle's the reason it's happening and realize we are in a national crisis. And it's only when we get those services across this nation that we will be able to get a handle on this problem without doing something to help us with mental health treatment, with drug addiction treatment, with the massive loss of federal resources for affordable housing. We will not, by ourselves, be able to get on top of this crisis.
Seattle Mayor Ed Murray will address the city tonight about the homelessness crisis, the state of emergency that he's declared. You can watch that speech on Seattle Channel at 7:30. That's Channel 21 on Comcast and Wave. You can also stream the speech on seattlechannel.org/live. Now, you just heard Mayor Murray say that he's asking the state to help homeless people. He'll have to compete for state lawmakers' attention as they deal with other problems like running our schools. That is a big focus this week as lawmakers began to lift two heavy boulders when it comes to education. We have KUOW's Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins here. Welcome, Austin.
Good to be here. Thanks, Bill.
What are lawmakers doing right now to educate our kids?
What they're doing is very quickly moving some education bills. We've seen the first bills out of the gates, really, to pass off the floor of each chamber. Education-related bills. So the Senate, controlled by Republicans, passed what they would consider to be a charter school fix measure that is a reaction to the Supreme Court finding that charter schools are unconstitutional. The House moved a package of education-related bills. Probably the primo one was the McCleary Plan Bill. This is the bill that tries to create a plan to get to full funding of public schools by the 2018 school year. McCleary, of course, is the Supreme Court case that found schools to not be being constitutionally funded by the state.
So we've got these two different education tracks going in our House and our state Senate. How are the tracks going to come together?
Well, they probably will come together because there is support on both sides of the aisle for a McCleary plan or a plan to get to full funding. And there's also support on both sides of the aisle for some sort of charter school fix. But I think what you're seeing is both chambers sort of putting a stake in the ground, creating something of a bargaining chip. I will say that charter schools is something that really appeals to Republican sensibilities because there's sort of a free market element to charter schools. Democrats are spending a lot of time talking about the fact that the million kids in public schools should be the first priority, not the many fewer who are in the state's charter schools today. So you're seeing some differences. My guess is at the end of this 60-day session, I would not be surprised to see this plan to get to full funding pass both chambers and some sort of charter school measure also pass both chambers.
Okay, so lawmakers are talking a lot about education. They're setting up their bargaining chips. What do you think is actually going to happen?
Well, I think they're going to get, you know, template something on paper passed, but you got to remember that the heavy lift waits for next year. That's 2017 is going to be the year when the legislature has to figure out how to finally take the pressure off of local levies and put it back into the state. And that is one tall order. Somebody described it as basically like rewriting 50% of the budget down here. So comparatively, whatever they do in this short 60-day election year session is going to be a very easy lift compared to what's upcoming for 2017.
That's your Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins. Thanks, Austin.
You're welcome.
You know, Nancy Pearl recommends books, right? She also shares the occasional travel tip.
I was in Cornwall a few years ago hiking, and it was just amazing, but there were no mermaids.
Oh, darn. Okay.
So, you know, take that as a little warning.
More of a Nancy Pearl in about 35 minutes here on KUOW. Speaking of travel, if you plan on taking a trip to the Galapagos Islands, a University of Washington researcher wants your vacation photo album. Dee Boersma has been studying penguins on the Galapagos for 40 years. Her website, igalapagos.org, asks tourists to share their photos of the island's penguins. Boersma told me she has no idea how many penguins live in the Galapagos, but she might be able to find the answer with the help of tourists' cameras.
Those penguins can be easily photographed, and because they have spots, many of them have spots on their chest, they're individually marked just like the freckles, you know, on your skin. Mm-hmm. And so if we can look at those, then we say, oh, yeah, that's the same one. We've got another picture of him. And, yeah, he's always around that area. But that's why it's important to have pictures, because they are worth a thousand words.
Why is it so difficult to study Galapagos penguins?
The real problem is that going to the Galapagos, as any tourist will know, is expensive. And as a scientist, we always are poor and rarely have enough money to do what we want to do. And it means I have to rent a boat and go out 2 days to where the penguins are to be able to see them or to take pictures of them. So we realized that, geez, these tourists, there's over 200,000 tourists that are going to the Galapagos every year. And if they could tell us when they took the picture, where they took the picture, we could tell them something about that penguin and learn something about what the penguins are doing.
You're making a virtue of people mobbing these precious islands.
Well, there's already 200,000 people going to these islands, so I'd like them to do something worthwhile for science. And Galapagos penguins are the rarest of all species of penguins.
Yeah, tell me about why are the penguins so important, and why have you been studying penguins for 40 years?
I guess I got started working on Galapagos penguins because I thought it was so crazy that a penguin could live on the equator. I mean, most people think that penguins should be in cold places, not on the equator. And these little penguins look like Jimmy Durante. I mean, they got a long beak for their size, and they're just kind of tiny. And I don't know, I fell in love with them. And so I just can't seem to let them go.
And they are scientifically important?
Well, are you scientifically important?
Absolutely.
Okay, then they are too.
Do they tell us valuable things about our environment?
Yes, they do. Penguins are really ocean sentinels, and they tell us a lot about what's happening in the oceanic environment and often even in the terrestrial environment. So I work mainly on Magellanic penguins in Argentina, but this year we've had a toxic algae bloom. Of course, many people have heard about the blob off the coast of Washington, and there have been literally thousands of dead MERS, which is a seabird. So seabirds can tell us a lot about what's happening in the environment. And of course, the environment's pretty important to humans, too.
And tell us about a tourist photo that's been really valuable to you.
Okay.
Describe that photo.
Okay. A group of tourists went up to this island called Genovesa, also known as Tower Island. It's kind of up in the northern part of the Galapagos, northeast. So it's an isolated island. There's never been a report of a Galapagos penguin up on Genovesa. And a tourist group went up there, and a guide took a picture of the Galapagos penguin. It's a juvenile, which means it's a young penguin, but certainly way out of where you would normally see a Galapagos penguin, and it was healthy. It was fat, and you could tell that by the picture. So those sorts of things, nobody had ever recorded a Galapagos penguin from Genovesa. So one photo told us that that penguin was in a place that normally it wasn't, and it was in good health.
And why does that matter that there's a penguin on Genovesa?
Well, if there's one penguin on Genovesa, there could be a second one that comes, and then we could have more. So if they can make a living up there, I mean, the population could expand to some of these other islands where, as far as we know, they've not been ever found or they've ever bred.
This is just amazing to me that my snapshot can tell you so much. How good a camera do I have to have? How good a photographer do I have to be? How much are you paying me for being your research assistant?
Well, that's the good news. We don't pay you a thing.
Oh, good.
But we do tell you something about what the picture is that you took. So we should be able to tell you something about that bird. Is it a juvenile? Is it an adult? Is it a male? Is it a female? Is it in breeding condition? Does it look like it's healthy and fat, or doesn't it? So those help us to know something about the distribution of Galapagos penguins. But as I say, there's not that many. So getting even a picture of some of these penguins can start to tell us, is it the same individual? Because penguins are not quite as distinct as you and me, but when you look at them for a while in their picture, you can start to tell them apart.
iPhone photo? Okay.
Oh, perfect. And you don't have to be a great photographer, and you don't have to get that close to them. But as long as it's got some clarity, we probably can learn something, you know, from that picture.
What do you want us to know and think differently about penguins and science?
I want people to realize that they can really make a contribution to science, even if they're not a scientist. They can do that with these pictures telling us about penguins. I couldn't do this research without people being interested in knowing more about penguins and learning more about the environment and how penguins are reflecting changes in our environment. So it's amazing what we can learn if we pay attention to penguins as ocean sentinels.
You want my Galapagos tortoise photos, too?
Well, there are probably people that would like them, but
not you.
I'm only interested in penguins.
And if you're interested in penguins, too, and thinking about traveling to the Galapagos Islands, maybe we just convince you to do that, Dee Boersma would really like your photos. You can find her photos and submit your own at igalapagos.org. Dee Boersma is a professor of conservation biology at the University of Washington, and she directs, get this, the Center for Penguins as Ocean Sentinels. Cool name, cool project. Thanks for listening. Good afternoon, KUOW. Thank you, Bernard. With the Iowa caucuses 6 days away, we're hearing about voters' fear and anxiety and anger at the national level, with Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders tapping into those emotions. How are voters feeling here in Washington State? We ask the people who pay attention to this full time, the state party chairs. Susan Hutchison heads the Washington State Republican Party. We talk to her and her Democratic counterpart. You'll hear those conversations all this week. First up, the economy. I asked Republican Susan Hutchison how much reason Washington voters have to feel anxious about the economy. She said it depends where you live.
If you're living in downtown Seattle, you have a sense, because of what's happening with Amazon and South Lake Union, you have a sense that, you know, that it's just an engine that's roaring in the state. If you live outside of Seattle, outside of Bellevue, Bellevue's even busier than Seattle these days. But if you live outside, if you live in the smaller cities or in eastern Washington, you have a different view of the economy. And that is more reflective of how people feel around the country. Seattle and Bellevue is in its own little bubble. And so around the country, people are discouraged by the economy. We've heard the statistics. We know that real income has not increased for almost a decade. We know that people are having to meet obligations, and around the country, people are feeling that.
How will Washington's Republican Party help the voter who is anxious about the economy right now?
The Republicans are known as the jobs party. We're the ones who support particularly that segment of the economy that grows jobs, which is small business. And we empower people by diminishing regulations that keep people unable to grow their businesses or expand employment. So, you know, everybody knows when you vote for Republicans, you're voting against regulation, government regulation, and you're voting for a stronger economy. And that's what we do. So I feel very encouraged that this is going to be a great year for Republicans, because we're known as the ones that provide a good economy.
What would you say is the number one priority for Republicans to either shrink government or expand jobs, or both?
Well, I can tell you that Bill Bryant, who is running for governor and would like to replace Jay Inslee, the incumbent, I think for starters, what he wants to do is embrace deregulation of our small businesses. And so if there is one thing Republicans can do to change the climate, and if you were to talk to a group of small business people, if you had them all in one room, the moment you mention the word regulation, you hear an ugh go throughout the room. It happens over and over. It doesn't matter if you're in a chamber of commerce or at the Rotary Club, which is full of small business owners, or just in a Republican Party event. You just always get that sense of, ugh, regulations, they're killing us.
How would you describe that feeling? Is it anxiety? Is it anger? What's the feeling behind that, ugh?
I think it is anxiety, and I do think it's anger. But in a lot of cases, it's just resignation. It's, ugh, how are we going to make this work? How are we going to move forward and make sure we can pay for our kids' college educations when the cost of doing business is growing and our profits are not? So we care deeply about people and their employment opportunities. We're also the party of upward mobility. And so what we are looking for, particularly with our young people, is for them to get into the job market with appropriate pay and opportunity to learn, to be good employees, and then the opportunity to thrive and end up reaching their potential.
Susan Hutchison chairs the Washington State Republican Party. She just gave you her take on how Washington State voters feel about the economy. Now, how are you feeling about the economy? Stacy Schaefer from Renton feels hopeful.
I think we live like in one of the most amazing places in the world, like this Puget Sound area, and like the companies that are here, the people that are here. I think everything here has the potential to be great, and so that gives me hope. God gives me hope. So that's, I always think there's opportunity regardless of what things look like.
And what about you? How do you feel about the economy this election year? Call us at 206-221-3663. Again, 221-3663. Or let us know on Twitter. Use the hashtag #electionfeels. I'm so glad you've tuned into The Record this afternoon. I'm Bill Radke. This month, the Seattle Archdiocese released a list of 77 priests and clergy members with credible or established accusations of sexual abuse against them. But when former Seattle resident Steve O'Connor saw the list, his abuser wasn't on it. O'Connor says he was raped repeatedly by a teacher named Dan Adamson in the early 1960s at St. Benedict Catholic School in Wallingford. O'Connor won a settlement from the order of priests who ran that school. He was awarded $8 million by a King County jury in 2012, but the church only released the names of priests and clergy, not teachers or other employees. Now, O'Connor is calling on the Seattle Archdiocese to expand the list to all church workers. Before you meet him, I warn you, this interview might not be appropriate for all listeners. Steve O'Connor told me about the abuse he suffered as a teenager.
Dan Adamson was the seventh grade teacher, but he was the omnipresent power at St. Benedict's. I was selected as his boy in the seventh grade. He came to my house and announced that I would be working weekends with him, traveling around the state, tuning pipe organs, that we would be staying overnight. My parents are both deceased, so I can't speak for them, but certainly no red flags were raised. God had called. The abuse was horrific. It was in various places. He was known by all the teachers, nuns, and priests to have an elaborate train set in his basement, and that's where he would take the victims, is to his basement, and then it would go to the attic, and then it would go to motels around the state. It would go to the school. And this story would be repeated by multiple victims. The victims who came forward at trial had the same testimony. And I think it's a terrible misconception for people to say, well, these people don't come forward till they're 60. I came forward at 12. The principal was put on notice, legal notice. I told the principal, a Dominican nun. I told Father Conrad in the confessional. I told other priests in the confessional. But I told them in a meeting. I told Father Conrad. And it was very heart-wrenching to watch other victims I'd never met come up on the witness stand at trial and talk about having a meeting with Father Conrad with their mother and having the same thing. You're going to hell. You're a liar. You can never talk about this. I have the power to send you to hell. And pre-Vatican II Catholics in that neighborhood, if I was told by a priest I was going to hell, I might as well jump off the bridge. That was literal. And it was reinforced by the parents.
Steve, how did suffering this abuse as a child affect the rest of your life?
The permanent damage, I'll just give you one example. If you interviewed my four children and you said, what kind of a dad? They'd say, oh, he's great. If you don't mind having someone look over your shoulder 24 hours a day. My kids never went to a dance without me chaperoning. My kids never went to a CYO meeting without me there. When they went to the CYO convention, I drove the van. When they went to parishes on CYO events, I walked the perimeter at night. And as I, in my old age, I look back and I know that not one of my children ever sat on my lap. And the most emotion I could drum up at each one of their weddings was to shake their hand. Now you can take that what you will, but I'm not a huggy type guy. And I just think that's a classic example.
How widespread do you think sexual abuse still is in the church and its schools and organizations?
All of my grandchildren attend Catholic school, with the exception of my son's two children who do not. I have grandchildren in several Catholic schools, and people ask, well, that's kind of a conflicting. I think it's less widespread. I think it's maybe minimal. I don't know for sure, but I do know when I go to a Catholic school or when I see my grandchildren at Catholic school, I see parents. I see parents picking them up. I see parents looking out for them. And that's the parental knowledge and the parental watchfulness is huge now. Nobody's getting away with a priest going to the parents and saying, your son has been chosen as my special altar boy, and throwing him to the wolves. No parents. I think if a parent saw a Catholic priest talking to their child, I think if my children saw a Catholic priest cornering one of my grandchildren in the corner of a schoolyard talking to him, there would be outrage and it would be immediate.
Why are your children and your grandchildren still in Catholic schools?
Because it's my children's choice to send them to Catholic school. I do want to say one thing about Catholic school. In my personal experience, some of the greatest life skills I learned at St. Benedict's, and I'll tell you what they were. They were how to take care of each other. I see 8th grade Catholic school children, and I see them talking to the 1st grader. I see them caring for the 2nd grader. I see the 3rd grader looking out for themselves. We looked out for each other at St. Benedict's because no one looked out for us. We were like a group of children who only had each other. The bonds at St. Benedict's, of the children at St. Benedict's, I still have friends that I went to grade school with, some of my closest friends. My wife grew up right down the street from me. I met her in the 2nd grade. She's a very fervent Catholic, one of the most heroic things I did at the conclusion of that trial was turn in my membership. I'll never be a Catholic again, ever.
Ultimately, Steve, what do you hope comes from your sharing your story of abuse?
I hope any victims who are abused by anyone at St. Benedict's do not sit in silence any longer. And that goes for all the parishes in the Archdiocese. Do not sit in silence any longer. You have people that will support you, people that defend you, people that will corroborate your testimony, as I did. I have to say right now, two of the bravest people I ever met in my life, and I saw a lot of brave police officers and a lot of brave Marines in combat. And the two bravest people were the people I'd never met that came forth with nothing to gain at my trial and testified. But by coming forward, just like the list with the Archdiocese, we've at least got a start. They at least, after years of inaction on this, have started to release. They must release all of the names of coaches, teachers, principals, youth ministers, volunteers with credible accusations against them. And they must quit having people try to call their hotline. They are not the legal. They are not the police. They do not have legal standing to tell people. People need to know their rights in these cases. Lives have been ruined for too long. It's got to stop.
Steve O'Connor won a settlement in King County for suffering rape and sexual abuse from his teacher at St. Benedict Catholic School in Seattle's Wallingford neighborhood in the early 1960s. That teacher, Dan Adamson, is deceased now. His name was not on the list released this month by the Seattle Archdiocese of 77 clergy who admitted to sexually assaulting children or whose allegations were either established or deemed to be credible. The Archdiocese spokesperson, Greg Mignone, confirmed to KUOW that the list is limited to the names of clergy and religious order members. In an email, Mignone said, "The church will continue to review its programs and protocols, and appropriate changes are carefully considered." You're listening to KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. Earlier this hour, we asked the head of the Washington State Republican Party, Susan Hutchison, how voters in Washington are feeling about the economy this election year. Jackson Ravens chairs the state Democratic Party. We wanted to know what he's hearing from voters about the economy, so I asked him, how hard is it right now for Washingtonians to get ahead financially?
Well, I mean, we've seen a challenge economically in this country overall as the incomes of the middle class have struggled to keep pace with some of the growth. But I think that as a whole, that, you know, we've been doing very well. I think that seeing an unemployment rate that we didn't think was going to get as low as it is, has made a huge difference in giving people a sense of job security. And I think what we need in our leadership is to continue the path that we have been following with Democratic leadership that's committed to this kind of economic growth that we've seen. We have to remember that, you know, when President Bush was in office, our country was losing about 800,000 jobs a month. And if you remember, we saw the foreclosures that were all over the street, you know, up and down the street. The financial crisis was wiping out worker savings, and we saw a lot of families that were facing bankruptcy over out-of-control health care costs. And with Democratic leadership, we've really been able to address a lot of these concerns, and that provides a sense of economic security and safety.
When it comes to the economy, what's your sense of the mood voters are in? What are they feeling?
Well, I think what we're talking about is, it's not an us and them type of conversation here. We're talking about our parents. We're talking about our husbands and wives and our children and our family and friends. And when we're talking about everybody participating in this economic growth, sharing in this economic growth, when we're talking about, you know, making sure there is a minimum wage that allows families to not live in poverty when they're working full time, we're not talking about sharing it with people that we don't know and that are estranged from us in some way. We're talking about those kind of opportunities being made available and existing for our families and friends. And so I think people are definitely interested in seeing the welfare of their families and friends improve. I think when we're talking about, you know, making sure that there is a paid sick leave available, that people aren't going to lose their jobs when they become ill. I mean, again, we're talking about our families and friends and making sure that they had stability and that they're, that they have health and employment. And when we're talking about equal pay for equal work, we are definitely talking about our family and friends. We're talking about, you know, hardworking women across the state and across this country who deserve equal pay for the work that they're doing. So I think that the mood is not so much about us and them or giving somebody to giving something or making something available to people that we don't know, but really recognizing the fact that that these type of economic developments and advances, these type of securities that we've been able to build in the last several years really affect all of us very personally and affect our families and friends and, you know, make a difference in our overall economic health and well-being.
Jackson Ravens chairs the Washington State Democratic Party, and he talked to us about how voters are feeling heading into the election year. We heard from the state Republican Party's Susan Hutchison earlier this hour. How are you feeling about your economic health and well-being? We asked a few locals at Northgate, and this is what Patrick Runyon said.
I'm concerned about staying in the middle class. I just wonder if I'll be able to make as much money as my parents did, since not currently making a lot of money.
What about you? How's the economy making you feel this year? Worried? Hopeful? Angry? Call us at 206-221-3663 and tell us your story, 221-3663. Or join the conversation on Twitter. Use the hashtag #electionfeels. All this week, we'll hear how voters in Washington State are feeling this election year on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. When KUOW listeners get stuck for what to read, help is a phone call away, as long as the person picking up the phone is Nancy Pearl. Here's Nancy with KUOW's Marcy Silman working the Book Lovers Recommendation Hotline.
Hi, this is Shannon from Friday Harbor.
Hi, Shannon.
Hi, Shannon. What do you do in Friday Harbor?
Well, I live there, but like so many people on the island, I commute to the mainland and work.
What do you do?
Federal worker. I work for the Economic Development Administration.
So do you get a lot of reading done on that ferry ride back and forth?
Yes, I do. Yep.
Well, tell us about the book that you most recently loved.
Oh, sure. Thank you. It's The Bay of Mermaids. I think it's Magia Comella. It was a romance and mystery combined together.
What, besides the romance and the mystery, made you like this book so much?
Oh, it was very descriptive. I feel like I've taken a trip to Cornwall now, which I'd like to do someday. You know, there's the romance, and you wonder where that's going to go. But, yeah, some other layers of mysteries to solve.
So the mystery and the romance and the setting, all of those are what really drew you to the book? Or is it something about mermaids in particular?
Well, mermaids, that was the first thing. We've got a store on the island called The Mystical Mermaid. They carry everything mermaid. And so my sister and I were in there one rainy afternoon, and I picked it up.
Have you always had a thing for mermaids?
Yes. And, yeah, I once had a therapist say, uh-oh, that's not good, but we won't go there. But I think it's because, you know, I mean, living on an island, you're surrounded by water, and how can you not like mermaids?
As far as I understand it, unless they're luring you to your death on the rocks, and that might be a siren, not a mermaid, they're probably pretty benign, right?
I would think so. Yeah, just plug those ears with wax.
Okay, so Nancy, there's mystery, there's romance, there's Cornwall, and mermaids.
And
so
mermaids.
What?
Well, the first thing I thought about was wanting to get a recording of somebody singing, "My father was the keeper of the Eddystone Light who slept with a mermaid one fine night. Out of this union, there came three, a porgy and a porpoise, and the other was me."
Oh,
So,
oh, I love that.
Yeah, you have to track down it. It's just a great standard American, or maybe a British. I'm not sure where it came from originally, but it was just wonderful. So I have some suggestions for you, Shannon.
Oh, great.
That I think that there's a good chance that you'll enjoy. And what I really concentrated on was less the Cornwall aspect of it, because if you want to read more about Cornwall, that's an easy thing to ask the librarian there in Friday Harbor. You know, they can find all the novels set in Cornwall that you could ever want. And I have to say, I was in Cornwall a few years ago hiking, and it was just amazing, but there were no mermaids.
Oh, darn. Okay.
So, you know, take it. That is a little warning. So an author that I really think you should check out is a woman named Sarah, with an H, Sarah Allison Allen. And her first book is called Garden Spells. And it's romance. It's a little bit of magic, a little bit of supernatural. It's one of those books that when people finish it, you know, they want to talk about it. They describe it as the kind of book that they felt like hugging. You know, it was one of those hugging books. So there's a whole series of them. But Garden Spells, I think, is her best one, and it's her first one. So don't miss that one. Another author that I think that you should take a look at is a woman named Alice Hoffman.
Oh, great writer.
But I want you to be very careful which books you read of hers, because her last four or five books are, they don't fit anything that you've said. So, you know, in the sense that I wouldn't recommend them to you. But she did a whole series of books that are really realistic. But then there's a little twist into magic, and they're her middle books. So I think a librarian could probably help you, you know, track down which of those. But Alice Hoffman is somebody I really want you to read.
Whoa.
And just on the off chance that you might want to try a new writer with a lot of books, there's a writer named Cassandra Clare. C-L-A-R-E, usually shelved with the teen books, always shelved with the books for teens, but ignore that part.
Okay.
And her first book is City of Bones. And so, you know, just give that a try and see what you think.
So Shannon, lists seem pretty good to you?
The description sounds wonderful, so I'm looking forward to the brain and reading.
Good. Oh, good. Thanks good. So much, Shannon. Enjoy it.
Okay, thank you.
My father was the keeper of the Eddystone Light. He married a mermaid one fine night. From this union there came three, a porpoise and a porgy, and the other was me. Yo, ho, ho.
We'll try to get that family photo up online for you. That's Marcy Stillman talking with Book Lust author Nancy Pearl. Luring Your Boat Away from the Rocks and Toward a Good Read, with, we heard the writers Sarah Addison Allen there, who wrote Garden Spells, and Cassandra Clare, City of Bones, and some mid-career Alice Hoffman. Anyway, you'll find those names of books and authors at KUOW.org later today. What can we do for you? Do you need a good book? Because we can help. Give us a call, 206-221-3663. Let us connect you with Nancy Pearl, but you realize this involves us knowing a little about you. Tell us about a book that you loved, one you wish you could read again for the first time, and why. That's key. Why did you love that one? We'll help you with the next one at 221-3663. Nancy will guide you to your next great read on KUOW.
And the phosphorus flashed in her seaweed hair. I looked again, and the mother wasn't there. A voice came echoing out of the night. The devil take the keeper of the Eddystone Light. Yo ho ho! The wind blows free. Oh, for a life on the rolling sea. Yo ho!